We are studying systematic theology. What's that mean, Christine? Systematic theology.
It means the theology of God and the systems and the order that He put into place.
Okay, it's a systematic, so it's an order. It puts things in order. And theology means what? The study of God. Systematic. A systematic, defined, organized study of God. Now, God has revealed Himself in several ways to mankind. Do you remember those ways? There's three basic ways that He's revealed Himself to mankind. Marilyn?
Yes.
Three ways that God has revealed Himself to mankind. Okay, nature. Wait a minute. We're going to look at nature. How does nature reveal God to you? What do you see, Schrader?
What do I see?
You go outside and this is nature needs natural things. What do you see? How does it God reveal Himself to you?
I guess the
how about stars? You ever look at stars? You see order in stars? Do you see order in snowflakes and rain? Do you see order in grass and animals? All of these things, we see order in them, don't we? We see a creator in this. They weren't created by systematic natural selection. They have order. What is one of the organs that probably mankind will never be able to transplant from one individual to the other? What is one of the organs?
The brain.
Well, the brain's one of them, yeah. Brain is pretty hard to transplant, even though we have Frankenstein and all this stuff, you know. Another one is the simple, the eye. The eye. The eye is another thing that you can't. Just think about the complexities of the eye. Do you think that the eye evolved? How about just the simple eye of a frog? And there's all kinds of eyes. There's fish eyes. There's frog eyes. You know, fish, reptiles, snakes, chickens. Just look at that. Now, if an animal has two eyes on the front of its being going one direction, going about 180 degrees, what kind of animal is that?
Predator.
That's a predator. Okay? If the animal has eyes on both sides, seeing 360 degrees, basically that is a what?
Right.
Prey or a victim. Okay? That's why they can see like that. Now, God didn't create them to be prey and predators to begin with, did He? But yet He saw ahead that this would be. Now, the complexity of that vision, the complexity of your mind. When people are born blind, they don't know how to transfer this information to their brain. And there have been operations performed on some people that allowed them to see. But after a certain age, it's too late to do that. Because the brain cannot remember and learn to transform this information that you see into the brain. It sees upside down. It sees things that aren't correct. Because you have to learn this from birth. You have to learn to see from birth. It is a learning process in your brain. And there's one account of that in the Bible. And remember, I told you that Bible and science and medicine and geology, archaeology and anthropology and all this all are not contrary. The Bible is not contrary to them. What about the man that was blind from his birth and Jesus healed him? What? It wasn't a complete healing to begin with, was it? What did he see?
He saw trees.
He saw men like trees. He didn't know how to differentiate. And the Lord healed him healed his mind now. He could not differentiate the information that he was getting to see normally. And God healed his mind and trained his mind to see thoroughly. That's medical. Do you think that those people back then knew this? No. But how much more fantastic is that miracle today than it was then? And here we have a natural thing. We have a body of a human being. We have an organ, which is an eye. We have not only the organ, which is the eye, but we have the brain that has to assimilate that information. So we have all of this there. And we see the Bible totally telling us how that happens and what this man saw before we ever even knew that. The Bible tells us in the days of Pele, God divided the earth, and that's physical. This is what we call physical science. Cindy taught physical science. Now, Cindy, she also is a mathematician, but she also taught physical science. Physical science means what?
Science of the physical world around you.
The science of the physical world, the natural world. We have the elements that make up iron and oxygen. H2O is what?
Water.
All right. Hydrogen, two parts of oxygen. We have water. H2O. We have all of these different, what we call, mathematical symbols of all of the natural things. Einstein says, I believe in God, but I really believe in mathematics. We see this. We have the natural world that tells us that there is a God. And then we have what else? Next, number two, Marilyn. Intuition. When you're born, you know that there is a God and you have a creator, even if you don't go to church. I remember that when I was young. I didn't go to church, but I always felt like there was a God. And my stepfather, Dale, had to tell me there was no God. And had to try to drive it into me to put doubt in my mind, because I still wanted to believe in God. I still wanted to believe in Him. And what's the number three thing, Sharon?
The Bible.
That's not what it's called, though. What's it called, Marilyn? Specific revelation. That's the Bible. And it's the prophets. Every prophet in the Bible, from Adam all the way down to Enoch, Elijah, Moses, all of these were prophets. Joseph was a prophet. But what? Jacob was a prophet. These are specific revelations God gave them. Noah was a prophet. Genesis 9, Bereshith 9, verses 24 onward, tells about the whole history of the human race before it even happened. Prophecy is one of the greatest things that prove that there is a God. Now, we studied a lot of things about God. Now, we're on page 122 in your book and my book. And I don't know what page it is in your book, Marilyn. I marked it for you, so you have to go find that. That's a different volume. It's marked there. On back a little further. Tell me what page that one's on.
Well, I have 77.
Page 77. Okay. What we're going to study here is lectures in systematic theology. We're using the book by Thiessen, this book, okay? And it looks like that also, with a cover on it, okay, guys and girls. And on page 122, it starts by saying this, the writer, self-existence. God is self-existing, is he not? Who brought God into existence? Ooh, the me, nothing. By self-existence, we mean that God has the ground of his existence in himself. He has the ground of his existence in himself. Where do you have the ground of your existence?
In God.
Where do you have the ground of your existence?
In me.
Huh? All the way back to Adam. Through your mother, through your father, all. Somebody had to play for 6,000 or so years. From Adam, we have been brought into being by our mothers and fathers cohabiting and bringing forth us as children. We answer to our mother and fathers. They answer to their mother and fathers. They answer to the mother and fathers all the way back until we come to God creating Adam. Adam didn't create himself. But you would think, according to some philosophical writers, that man created himself. That he was the super intelligent animal. And when you teach people that they're animals, they act like animals, don't they? That's why we have such a messed up world. God has the ground of existence in himself. We have the ground of our existence outside of ourselves. We didn't bring ourselves into the world. You understand that? We did not originate with saying, "Here I am." Zip one day. But God is not dependent for his existence upon anything outside of himself. What are we dependent upon in our existence, Sharon?
God. Everything. I mean, from breath.
Air.
Yeah, I mean,
water. Food.
Yeah.
Sunlight. Gravity.
Mm-hmm.
All of these things. We have our existence in that. And that existence is in how God created the world and man. But God is not dependent on existence upon anything outside of himself. As Thomas Aquinas said, he is the first cause, himself uncaused. He is the first cause, himself uncaused. His self-existence is implied in his affirmation, "I am that I am, asher hayah asher, ego eimi." I said it in Hebrew, and I say it in Greek. I am that I am. Exodus 3 and 14. And as is usually held in the name Jehovah, how do we say that? They say Yahweh and all that kind of stuff, but all I can see there is Yah. Yah. Elijah. Elisha. Ah, Yah. Okay. Yet God's self-existence is not grounded in his will, but in his nature. Not in his will, but in his nature. God isn't the big brain that created himself. Do you get that? He exists by the necessity of his nature. It is not correct to say that God is his own cause. For if that were the case, he would have the power to annihilate himself. Now, we can go kill ourselves, can't we? Yet we don't go out of existence. Our soul and spirit's gone. We can kill our body. And Jesus says, don't worry about who that can kill your body, but who that can throw your soul and spirit into Hades. Number three, immensity. Is God big? Is God big? I always try to make God bigger. In people's minds, I try to show him how immense he is. I try to show people how immense God is. By the immensity of God, we mean that his infinity in relation to space. We are finite. He is infinite. He is infinite. God is not limited or circumscribed by space. On the contrary, all finite space is dependent upon him. You learn something with this? This is some nice things about God. He is, in fact, above space, isn't he? Who created space? God. Now, we see the universe, but God created the space that the universe is in. Do you understand that? God created the universe and all the physical elements of the universe, but what about space? That had to be created too. The scriptures teach the immensity of God in 1 Kings 8:27, 2 Chronicles 2 and 6, and Jeremiah 23:24, Psalm 139 and 7 onward, Isaiah 66 and verse 1, and Acts 17 and verse 28. Now, we could read every one of those, but we'd never get through this book. We find this a difficult idea to comprehend and to apprehend, don't we? This is due to the spirituality of his nature and our inability to think in spaceless terms. Our inability to think in spaceless terms. Can we imagine what God really is? Can we all? Yeah, we're going to get to that. Space. God is not dependent upon space. He made space. He created space. However, this much is clear. God is both immanent and transcendent. He is everywhere, present in essence, as well as in knowledge and power. He is everywhere. That's his omniscient and omnipotent and omnipresent. Spiritual substance, like the soul, is present, whether it is present as a complete whole at any point. You have a soul that is what you might call intrinsic. It is something that you can't hold down. You can't put your hand on it. Remember the last class I taught, I said when people died, we've had some people that really wandered. When they die, are they lighter? When their spirit leaves, are they lighter? And you can look on Google, and you can see where people were weighed, and at death, they got lighter. You explain that one now. Is that mind-boggling? Eternity. By the eternity of God, we mean his infinity in relationship to time. Eternity past, eternity future. And during that period, that sphere of eternity, we have a little tiny itsy-bitsy piece of human history and the history of the heavens and the earth. That much in eternity, not even that much, because eternity is tremendous. When we get married, we put on rings. Anybody got a ring? Mm-hmm. It's supposed to be a circle without beginning, without end. Standing for eternity, your eternal love for one another. Eternity. But God has taken a little bit of space and time and had us live in that space and time, and that's where we live today. Isn't that cool? By the eternity of God, we mean his infinity in relationship to time. We mean that he is without beginning or end. Asher, Haya, Asher, in arche ein hologos, kai hologos ein proston theon, kai hologos ein theos. These are Hebrew terms. I am that I am, Asher, Haya Asher. I am that I am. And in arche ein hologos, in beginning, before in eternity past, he kept on being the Jehovah, the Eternal One. He kept on being. And he kept on being in an inseparable part of the Godhead, Kai Logos, ein proston theon. And he kept on being an inseparable proston theon, inseparable part of the Godhead. Jesus never ceased being God when he's on earth, did he? Even though he was flesh, then now we have God began and became flesh, don't we? That he is free from all succession of time, free from all succession of time. And that he is the cause of time. He created time. He created chronos and he created kairos. Seasons and time. That he is without beginning or end and may be inferred from the fact of his necessary existence. He who exists by reason of his nature rather than his volition. He doesn't exist because he wishes himself to exist. He didn't create himself. You get that? God did not create himself. God did not create himself in the man and the mind of mankind. Many people say, well, we are emotionally not strong enough to stand on our own, so we have created a God. The God didn't create himself either. His volition must always have existed and must continue to exist forever. that God is eternal is abundantly taught in the Scriptures. He is called the what? The eternal God, is he not? Olam. Olam means what, Brother Roger?
After you imagine what forever is, then that's where it starts.
Okay, when you can imagine and get no further with any space or time or anything, and got it all the way back there, that's where Olam begins. Ace Tony on Tony on. That's the Greek existence of it. That means ages upon 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 ages without end. We see this. How long did Lucifer actually follow God?
We don't know.
Well, it was in eternity past, wasn't it? In Genesis 21:23, the psalmist says, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. Psalm 90 and verse 2. And you are the same, and your years have no end. Psalm 102 verse 27. And Isaiah represents God as the high and the lofty one that inhabits eternity. He inhabits eternity. He is the eternal God. Isaiah 57:15. Paul says that he only has immortality in 1 Timothy 6:18. He is from all succession of time. Time is commonly understood duration measured by succession. We measure time by what? Seconds?
Hours, minutes,
seconds,
days.
Minutes, hours, days,
months,
years. Seasons, years. Years. A year means what, Brother Roger, in Hebrew? It means the whole complete succession of seasons. So that's 1 year. We went from seconds to years. And we go from years to lustrums, to decades, to centuries, to millenniums. But yet God is the one that inhabits and created all this. Time is as commonly understood duration of measure succession. Shedd says, God has a simultaneous possession of his total duration. God has a simultaneous possession of his total duration. That's hard. The whole of the divine knowledge and experience is ever before the divine being, so that they are not parts of succeeding parts. They're not part of the whole. Eternity for God is always now. When God sees us, he sees us in our eternal way. When he looks upon us as a child of God, he sees us in our eternal glory with him. When he sees the lost, he sees them in eternal hell. Whew. That's got to be hard, isn't it? Because God also gives them the key of their eternal existence by giving them volition. In Scripture, it is referred to as this day in Psalm 2 and verse 7 and 2 Peter 3 and 8. But we must not suppose that time now that it exists has no objective reality for God, but rather that he sees the past and the future, the past and present and future as if it's one now. Get it? He sees the past, what happened in eternity past, the present, what's going on right now, and the future as it will be in eternity future as an ever-existing now. Is this doing you any good, Roger?
It's blowing my mind.
It's blowing my mind. I taught this 40 years ago. One may view a procession from the top of a higher tower, where one can see it all at one glance, or one may view it from the street corner, where one can see it only as one part of it at a time. God sees it all in the former way, although he is aware of the subsequence in the procession. God is looking from eternity down into space and time, but he's not locked there because he can see us in a future, eternity future. He sees the saved with him, and he sees the lost away from him. And he's not locked down by just the present tense. He is also the cause of time in Hebrews 1 and 2 and 11:3. Both time and space are among the all things which were made through him, John 1 and 3. And Strong says, yet time and space are not substances. Neither are they attributes, quantities of substances, qualities of substances. They are rather relations of finite existence. We relate to finite things, don't we? Because we live in a finite world. You get hungry? You getting hungry yet? Yeah. All right. When was the last time you ate? About noon?
Yeah.
Well, when you got my mother, we used to trape across the country with her and my stepdad, and we went across the country several times together. And my mother said, where are we going to eat? Where are we going to eat? Where are we going to eat? We get over to some place in Tucumcari, Mexico, or someplace. Tucumcari, New Mexico, or Tombstone, Arizona, or something. And we'd eat. And right when we walk out of the restaurant, she said, where are we going to eat next time? We're finite, aren't we? We live by our appetites. We get tired. Eat her in the afternoon. Now, see, you get tired. After you eat a big lunch, you get tired. If you eat something sweet, you get tired. You know why if you eat something sweet, you get tired?
Because you go hard.
Your blood goes zoop like that, and it either will go into hyperglycemia or it will make you rest. And then you go lay down and take a little nap or a short, brief siesta. With finite existence, they come into being. They are not mere regulative conceptions of our minds. They exist objectively, whether we perceive them or not. Did Moses really live?
Yes.
Did he or did he not? When did he live? The Bible tells us when he lived. Right over here. This period of time. When did Joseph live? Way over yonder. Right here. How about the all of those hundreds and thousands and millions of Egyptians in the Egyptian bondage, did they really exist? Even though they're not there right now, did they exist?
Mm-hmm.
All of the ovens in Germany that they killed all the Jews and the Polish, by the way, that killed everybody. They melted down their teeth and whatever. Did these people really live? Do we have photographs of them? How many people in your life, how far back can you remember? How far back do you know of in your life, Christine? How many generations do you know the names of these people?
Maybe four.
Four generations. I can go back several generations with my family, and they have these family trees. How many?
1,500.
1,500. Well, on my Chickasaw side of my family, I can go back beyond 1,400. Moshokchu, in Moshokchu, that family. They were here when Cortez came. They were here when they went across the State Plains. They were here at that time, and they were an old family then. And they had these great big plantations. They went down and down and down and down and down. Now, we can go back and we can trace our family sometimes 1,000 years, but that's nothing. Zilch. And we run out. Now you can do your DNA and you can trace yourselves all the way back to the Fertile Crescent. And you know it's there. But even if you go back 6,000 years or so, that's nothing. That's nothing. Time will someday merge into eternity. Shedd thinks, however, that for the creature, eternity will not be a successionless existence, for every finite mind must think, feel, and act in time.
Okay, yeah, the pastor said something about that on Sunday,
mm-hmm.
That even in our in our existence in eternity will still be bound in our timeline.
In our mind. We will remember. We will see a day at a time. But God is not held down by that, is he?
But yet there's no day in heaven, no day and night. So how is that going to happen?
Well, yes, there will be. At least. How long? How many years will we count in heaven with the Lord after the rapture?
1,000, I guess.
1,000 at least.
Okay.
That's the millennium. And then eternity begins again. Will we be able to look back and remember the 1,000 years?
Well,
will we remember the next 1,000 years?
You can check your DNA and figure out
we're all cousins. Yeah. Number 123, the attributes of God. This is mind-boggling. By the attributes of God in distinction from the substance of God. By the attributes of God, by the substance of God. There's a difference between attributes and substance. The attributes are what? That is the personality. It's the substance that he is exists. Okay? Is distinction from substance of God, we mean the qualities that inhere in the substance and constitute an analytical and closer description of him. They are to be thought of as objectively real and not merely as man's subjective mode of conceiving God. The God is real. He is not a figment of our imagination. And as descriptions of the particular ways in which the divine God, the divine existence exists and operates, and not as denoting distinct parts of God, the attributes are the differentia of the genus, or essence, or substance. The attributes are the differentia of the genus, of the existence, of the beginning of our understanding of God, his essence and substance.
What in the world does all that mean?
I'm trying to diagram. I
differentia means what? Different.
It means to be able to tell.
To see the different attributes of God. What makes God? John said it in one word, God is love. But God is also justice. Can God look upon the sinners for eternity? Even though he can see them in eternity in hell today, does God suffer over every one of them, dealing and trying to lead every one of them to himself?
Yes.
According to our theology, he does.
He doesn't wish that any perish.
He does not wish that any should perish.
Now, will there come a time when God will forget them?
Can God forget anything?
He forgets our sins. He removes them.
He just removes them. He moves them way out yonder in file 13. So you don't have to look at them, so he doesn't have to be in the presence of them. And so that they don't have to be in the presence of God, because they would be more tormented being in the presence of God than away from him. Would they not? Various classifications of the attributes have been made. One of the best known is in the division into the natural. Natural, relating to nature. God's attributes in reference to and in contrast with nature and moral. His attributes as moral governor. Another is into the immanent. Those which relate to God as he is in himself. Eminent means he's here. That he can walk into our world at any time. And he does. You're going to do anything outside of the person of God. You're not going to do anything outside of him knowing it. Because he's always there. And transitive. Those by which he is revealed outwardly in his relations to his creation. Third, it is in positive by which certain perfections are expressed, and in negative by which certain limitations are denied. A fourth is derived from the constitution of our own nature, what we can understand. As in man, there is a substance of the soul, there's a substance of the intellect, there's a substance of the will in that intellect. And so it is said, we may arrange the attributes of God under three heads, those pertaining to his essence, those pertaining to his intellect, and those pertaining or relating to his will. Genesis 1:26. Let us make man in our shadow casting likeness, spiritual likeness, in our blood flowing likeness, and in our sovereign likeness. We shall, however, divide them into non-moral and the moral. The non-moral and the moral. The non-moral attributes. By the non-moral attributes, we mean that those necessary predicates of the divine essence that do not evolve moral qualities. Can God sin?
No.
No. So that's not considered. We would add, however, on page 124, that they have a direct bearing on human conduct. When you sin, do you know it?
Sometimes.
Yes. Sometimes you don't you? Mm-hmm. The non-moral attributes are omnipresence, omniscience, omnipotence, and immutability. Let us study these in the order indicated his omnipresence. By the omnipresence of God, we mean that he is infinite in relation to his creatures. Because God is immense, he is omnipresent. The Bible teaches the omnipresence of God, and David says, whither shall I go to flee from your presence? And if I ascend up into heaven, you're there. And if I make my bed in Sheol, behold, you are there. Psalm 139:7-12, Jeremiah 23:23-24. Paul says he is not far from each one of us, for in him we live, we move, and we have our being. Acts 17:27-28. And by the way, he quoted a pagan poet and philosopher when he did that. But he spoke in their colloquial terms and their what we call vernacular of that day, so they could understand. This is a condescension, so to speak. The omnipresence of God is a source of comfort to the believer. Faber says beautifully, for God is never so far off or even to be near. He is within our spirit, is in the home he holds most dear. To think of him as by our side is almost as untrue as to remove his shrine beyond those skies in starry blue. So all the while I thought myself homeless, forlorn and weary, missing my joy, I walked the earth myself, God's sanctuary. Wherever you are, God is there, even under a bridge. How many of you ever had a hobo dinner? Have you ever had a hobo dinner, Marilyn?
Yeah.
What's a hobo dinner? I cook one for you a time or two.
Yeah.
You know what you do with a hobo dinner? You find a tin can someplace. Uh-huh. And you cut up some potatoes and throw a piece of bacon in there, or a piece of meat, or a chicken leg or something, or some sparrow. Throw it in that can and build a fire and put it on there until it cooks it. And that's a hobo dinner. You can make a hobo dinner in your oven by taking something with tinfoil even. I used to make hobo dinners with tinfoil. I used to take them when I was going woodcutting, take them when I was going hunting, and I would take a sausage or hamburger, and I would take it in a tinfoil, real thick tinfoil, put an onion in there, and potatoes, carrots, sweet potato, whatever you wanted to put in there, even beans. You put it in there, wrap it up, and stick it on the intake manifold of your car. And if you got to drive 2 or 3 hours, when you get there, it's done. Mm-hmm. Or you can drive around all night long, and it's going to be hot. We used to have to drive around up there following and spotlighting, looking for bear and lion and coons and bobcats and raccoons and, possum and everything. We would fox. We'd spotlight and look into these, and we'd be going real slow. And all the time our food's cooking. Whenever we get hungry, we stop and eat. That's a hobo dinner. For God is never far away. The thought of his presence is subduing and encouraging. To the unbeliever, it is a source of warning and restraint. No matter how much he may try, he cannot escape from God. Neither distance nor darkness hide from him, for there is no creature that is not manifest in his sight. But all things are naked and laid open before the eyes of him with whom we have to do. Hebrews 4:13. The consciousness often checks the sinner in his evil ways and leads him to God, and it also checks the saved person and leads him in the ways of God also. Does it not? The omniscience. By the omniscience of God, we mean that he knows himself. He knows himself. And all other things, whether they are actual or merely possible, whether they physical or material, physical, material, or spiritual. Is there one spirit that he doesn't know about? Wandering around, wandering spirits? Whether they be past, present, or future, and that he knows them perfectly and from all eternity. He knows things immediately and simultaneously and exhaustively and truly. And he also knows the best ways to attain his desired ends. Best way to obtain the desired ends. His omniscience is proved by the evidences of desire, design, and creation, of intelligence in mankind. And animals! Don't make God less by saying animals can't think. That's a creation, isn't it? Think you're going to leave something out there that can't think? We all think about these brute beasts. These just mean nothing. Have no feelings. They do. These evidences are found in the animate world, the inanimate world, and in the relation between the two worlds. Relation between the two worlds, the animate and the inanimate. They find their highest expression in the intelligence of man, we think. It is proved by his omnipresence, Proverbs 15:3. The eyes of Jehovah are in every place, keeping watch upon the evil and the good. Jeremiah 23:23-25. Am I a God at hand, said Jehovah, and not a God afar off? Can any hide himself in secret places so that I shall not see him, says Jehovah? Do not I fill the heaven and the earth? Wherever you are, he's there. In your dreams at night, he's there. In your dreams at night, he's there. In your spirit, he's there. In your soul, he's there. In your body, wherever it is, he's there. Psalm 139, 1-10. It is proved also by the express declaration of the Scriptures, Psalm 15 and verse 11. Sheol and Abaddon are before Jehovah. How much more than the hearts of the children of men? Did you hear just what I said? Sheol and Abaddon are before the eyes of the Lord. Remember what I told you, that he sees the lost in hell today. That he sees the saved in heaven today. Psalm 147, verse 5. Great is our Lord and mighty in power. His understanding is infinite. Isaiah 46 and verse 10, declaring the end from beginning, the ancient times, things that are not yet done. Hebrews 4:13. He has no problem with prophecy, does he? There is no creature that is not manifest in his sight, but all things are naked and laid open before the eyes of him with whom we have to do. Matthew 10 and 30, the very hairs of our head are all numbered, and there aren't many left. Radiation and chemotherapy took care of some of that. And just plain old age. Note the scope of his knowledge. First of all, as Chanak says, God knows himself and he only knows himself. We get a glimpse of who he is through the Scriptures. We get a glimpse of who he is through theology. But only he knows himself. This is the first and original knowledge wherein he excels all creatures. No man does exactly know himself. You don't know yourself, do you? We live in our wicked souls, we do. But we don't know ourselves. We don't know our future. All we do is walk one step at a time in space and time, which is all we know how to do. Much less does he understand the full nature of a spirit, much less still the nature of the perfection of God. Stephen Charnock wrote this in The Existence and Attributes of God. This is substantiated by what Jesus said, "No man knows the Son save the Father, nor any man the Father save the Son. And he who whomsoever the Son wills to reveal him," Matthew 11:27. And Paul says, "For who among men know the things of a man, save the spirit of the man which is in him? Even so the things of God none knows save the Spirit of God." 1 Corinthians 2:11. That is, the Father, the Son, and the Spirit know each other perfectly, and they only have such knowledge of each other. Jesus in Gethsemane, that is something else, isn't it? "If this cup can pass from me, let it pass." He was speaking that in his humanity. God also knows things exactly, but Jesus was living in space and time, wasn't he? And yet he knew the beginning from the end. And yet he was still tormented by the present tense, because he knew presently something bad was going to happen to him. God also knows things exactly, actually existing as intimate creation. Psalm 147:4. Brute creation, Matthew 10:29. Men and all their works, Psalm 33:13-15. Men's thoughts and their hearts, Psalm 139:1-4. And men's wants, Matthew 6:8-32. He also knows all things possible, as he knew that Keliah would betray David to Saul. If he remained in that vicinity, in 1 Samuel 23:11-12, as Jesus knew that Tyre and Sidon would have repented. They would have repented if I'd have done all these miracles in them. Had they seen the miracles that were done in Bethsaida and Chorazin and all of those places, Bethany. Matthew 11:21. And that Sodom and Gomorrah would have been spared had they seen the works that were done in Capernaum. Matthew 11:23-24. Certain idealists deny a distinction between knowledge and power, holding that knowledge and thought always mean the exertion of creative power. According to this, God creates by thinking and knowing. But the possession of a faculty and the exercise of it are two different things. The possession and the faculty and the exercise of it are two different things. Thus, God has knowledge of the possible as well as the actual. Jesus Christ died for all mankind's sins. It would only be effective or efficacious to the elect that would believe, not because God made them, but because they have volition. That's one of the gifts in the creation, the sovereignty. God also knows the future. From man's standpoint, God's knowledge of the future is foreknowledge. But not from God's sense. He knows all things by one simultaneously intuition. He foreknew the future in general. Isaiah 46:9-10. Daniel 2:7. Matthew 24 and Matthew 25, Acts 15:18, the evil course that Israel would take in Deuteronomy 31:20-21. He knew that they would sin. He knew that he would punish them. And the coming and works of Cyrus, Isaiah 44:26-45-7. The coming of Messiah, Micah 5:2. The fact of the wicked men would crucify him, Revelation 13:8. And Acts 2:23-3:18. But prescience is not itself causative, as must not confuse foreknowledge and determining of the will of God. God didn't make it happen that way. He didn't make that happen. He doesn't make you believe. He doesn't make you reject. Free actions do not take place because they are foreseen, but they are foreseen because they will take place. Free actions do not take place because they are foreseen, they take place that they are foreseen because they will take place. Hod says that free acts may be absolutely certain is plain because they have in a multitude of causes been predicted. Wisdom is the intelligence of God's display in the choice of the highest ends and the fittest means for the accomplishment of those ends. I often wondered why God called me to preach. I often wondered that. I often wondered why he gave me the ability to see the languages and the deep theology that so many people aren't interested in. And yet now I see that, and I wondered why. I always wished that we could get it out on the internet, and now it's there. We're reaching thousands of people. Today, people are going to be built up by this lesson. And he allowed this. I have been through a lot of bad things in my life, and going through a lot of bad things in my life. Seems like it's omnipresent always. Yet, I know in the end, God will be glorified in some way. Though God sincerely seeks to promote the happiness of his creatures and to perfect the saints in holiness, neither of these are the highest possible ends. The end is his own glory. All his works are in creation, Psalm 19, 1 through 6, 104, Proverbs 3:19, preservation, Nehemiah 9 and 6, and Revelation 4 and 11, providence, Psalm 33 and 10 and 11, Daniel 4:35, Ephesians 1 and 11, and redemption in 1 Corinthians 2:7 and Ephesians 3:10 have this end in view. Do you have any questions? A million?
Yeah, my brain is...
Did you get something? Did you get something?
Yes.
Put it underneath.
I thought that I know nothing. And I gotta learn a lot more.
Did you think you knew something about God, Brother Roger?
No.
Did you think you knew God, Schrader? Now you know that you're just beginning to know him. And that it's infinite. And you're finite. But is it possible that we can learn? Is it possible that we can glorify God by learning and seeing him bigger than we did yesterday or this morning? Can we glorify him greater by realizing how great he is and knowing that he is the creator of all things, that he created us, that we are dependent upon him, but he is not dependent upon us? He's not dependent upon us. And yet, he has chosen to use us in some way.
So back when God created Adam and Eve, they were perfect.
Yes.
So obviously they were more intelligent, more healthy.
More intelligent than me.
More everything than what we are now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But even in their perfect state, they would still be learning.
They would still be finite.
That's why God,
because God is infinite. They are finite. He is infinite. Even though they are made in the image of God.
And even though they were made to really never die.
That's right.
They had a beginning.
They had a beginning. God does not have a beginning. In our K, ain ho logos. Kai ho logos. Ain proston teon. Kai ho logos ain teos. Asher haya asher. He is that he is. Always that he is. He is that he always is. He always is there. He was there billions of years before he ever decided to create us.
I wonder what he was doing then.
What was he doing then?
Yeah.
Ooh, the me, I don't know. All I can do is tell you what's been revealed to me, and I can go and I can take and show you some of the things. We went from page 122 through 126 today, didn't we?
Mm-hmm.
Did you learn something?
Yeah.
Too much? It's not. It's just beginning.
Yeah, I'm going to have to digest a lot of it.
You can't learn. There is a time element in what?
Learning.
Do you realize that now?
Yeah.
Brother Roger, I used to really struggle with mathematics. I struggled with the times table. I struggled with the eight cases of Greek, and I struggled with all of the tenses of the Greek and the Hebrew languages. And I looked at all of his stuff, and I just kept studying it. And one day, my teacher says, "You've gone beyond me. Don't you ask any more questions about Greek. You've gone beyond me. I don't understand what you're talking about anymore." You know, like one of those grammar books or something. And that made me really deflated. Really. Because I had nobody to go to. I had no one. I could say, "Hey, am I right here? I don't know whether you're right or not." What do you see in this verse right here? In this tense and in all of this? One of the teachers of it, Fresno Missionary Baptist Institute, I was talking to him here a while back. I said, go to the website, discovertheword.drjim.com, look over at John 1:1, 1:14, 1:18. He looked at that and he called me about a week or two later and he said, "You know something, we didn't learn that in school." He said, "This is beyond what we were taught in seminary in our Hebrew or our Greek classes, even in the Hebrew class," because he said, "You're relating the Greek and the Hebrew all together, intermingling them so they can understand it better." Asher haya asher, in arche en ho logos. We see this now. You see this as it's revealed to you. And there's a time element in learning. There's a time element. He went and preached three messages on John. A John 1 and 1 message, John 1 14 message, John 1 18 message. And used all the scriptures because now he understood it better than he ever did before. There's a time element in learning. And he's a great teacher and a writer of Sunday school material, and yet he learned something. And he just had, when you learn something, you just have to share something, don't you? Well, see, I wanted to teach the Kingdom of God series. The Kingdom of God series, because we never finished it in seminary. I wanted to teach the God's eternal purpose, because we never finished it in seminary. I wanted to finish it. And I just began to teach these classes and record down so others could hear them. And I got them done. Now I'm doing systematic theology. Now, if it's up to God whether he wants me to go through this or not, whether I live through it or not, who knows whether I will get to the end of this book? Who knows whether I'll finish up all the parables of the Bible? I'm about probably almost into the New Testament. I still got some more Old Testament books. I'm in Zechariah, and Zechariah means what? What does Zechariah mean? Come on, Marilyn. God remembers.
Oh, I knew that.
Hey, God remembers because he knows all things, doesn't he? Mm-hmm. All right, he knows all things. Do you understand that better now? Do you understand the attributes of God? Jehovah Jireh, you know, the God who is there. Jehovah Shammah, the God who is there all over. Jehovah Elohim. Jehovah Rafika. We see all of these titles of God. And yet we know now how he did that. How he healed a blind man. I guarantee you those apostles didn't understand what we just understood and explained tonight. He didn't know. They did not know that. They didn't know about medical world like that. But they put it in the book. They put it in the book. And so we can understand it and we can see God bigger and how God thoroughly healed that man. He healed his mind and he healed his eyes. Both. And he'd been born that way. And he was old. And the Jews didn't want to accept that because only the Messiah could heal the blind. And so they went after him. They went after his parents. They kicked him out of the synagogue, harassed him and harassed him and harassed him. And he's like, "Hey, who do you heal you?" And he's like, "I don't know." Then he came back later on. "I know who it is now. I know who it is. It's Jesus." That's it. Who did it? The man that had never walked, and he got up and walked and carried off his pallet with him. Who was that guy? "I don't know. It was him." Later on, they find out. Who saved you? Jesus, the eternal God. the one that's infinite, and we are finite. And God subjected himself to space and time in the person of Jesus Christ. Do you realize how great that gift was? The infinite God that inhabits all eternity, but yet brought himself into space and time so he could save us.
And in some ways limited himself.
Yes. Greatly. So he could taste death. He was born to die. Did I help? Did something? Did you get something today, Roger? You get something you can share? You got something you can share? All right, let's go out and do it. Let's go out and do something eternal. All right. Brother Roger, would you dismiss us in prayer? If you don't have any questions, I think this floundered you and foundered you.
It's this big.
Okay, Brother Roger.
Father, thank you for allowing us to explore your attributes and your substance today.